afternoon and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam Mulvey is off again this week, but I am back from a break, returning from Camp Quest Northwest. And with me in the studio, I am so excited to have both Wesley and Meredith. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to you too, Becky. We missed you.
Hooray.
Man, I would like to say that I missed everyone else, but hey, I was off in my own little bubble at Camp Quest Northwest. The biggest little dose of outside world that I got was as far as the headlines. And we looked at the headlines, and some of the headlines were interesting and buoying, and some of the headlines we said, nope, 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 not clicking on that. Going back to dealing with bug juice and campfire fires and run around repeat after me songs and some awesome investigation and as usual kids campers, volunteers, everyone was super amazing. And it's really refreshing to be in an environment where you have hope for the future, where you have increased understanding of skepticism and critical thinking, and all through a secular lens, and that just is the most refreshing little dose of well, anything. But speaking of secular, we've got some interesting things from across the continent and across the pond. So we got to jump a continent, and then we got to jump across the whole pond, the Atlantic one, because a city councillor in Leicester in the United Kingdom has asked the city to re-examine its policy on the sale of council-owned buildings to religious organizations. Rita Patel feels that the increase in religious buildings is causing conflict within their secular community, explaining that whenever one of the buildings is sold to a religious group, there are people in the city who lose the use of that space. She argued that all people should feel that they have access to open spaces and buildings that belong to them as citizens. And as a solution, Patel is asking to put a cap on the number of buildings the city can sell to religious organizations. Under the current city policy, there's no way to differentiate between religious communities and groups focused on leisure or social assembly.
Wow, goodness. I wouldn't have expected Leicester to have so many, buildings that the government owned that they could actually sell to people, but this is I like the idea. What are you thinking, Bo?
I think there are some interesting implications here, especially with the policy making.
I would want to make sure that it wasn't necessarily sort of a backhanded, coded way of saying we don't want to increase our municipal revenue by selling off things to religious organizations that we don't particularly care for. We've seen a lot of, conflict between not so much Anglican Church necessarily, but other kinds of less typical minority religions. So I would want to make sure that this isn't a backhanded way of saying, hey, we don't want any Muslim community centers in our city.
It's actually really interesting that you bring that point up, because something that was mentioned in the article was a lot of the buildings that are being sold from the city are being sold to minority groups.
So we're talking Jehovah's Witnesses or evangelical
Krishnas, Buddhists.
They need a space too.
They do need spaces too, but we're not talking about trying to push out the Catholic Church or the
Anglican Church, of England there, things like that. So this a smack against pluralism, a pluralistic society? Is this we just really want spaces like libraries and municipal buildings and grand halls that are open to everyone? It's kind of an interesting thing, and I'm not so familiar with the politics or the social leanings of folks in that area of the United Kingdom, but I know that we have lots of listeners that are in the UK and maybe could provide some more insight into that. What do you guys think, though, in contrast to what we do in the United States, where we have municipal buildings like schools or community centers that then are permitted to be rented out to churches? I mean, some schools don't have any theater use of their theater or auditorium at all on Sunday because you have three churches holding
exactly.
services there.
Yeah, it's a fuzzy little line. There's not a real clear black and white on it, and I think that's what makes it an interesting issue to talk about. Where does the city get to draw the line with any city, with religious institutions?
I mean, here you can rent, once you rent it out to one theater group, right, or one choral performance, you got to be able to rent it out to anyone, and that's our U.S. laws. Do you think that it would be good if you have disused, you know, facilities to sell them off to burgeoning religious groups, or sell them off to, you know, have that way to differentiate between, this is just the Mountaineers Club that wants to have this building so that they can talk about environmental stewardship and rock climbing?
I mean, of course, it's much better to have a building being used than not, but I mean, why can't they look into getting somebody to help rent those buildings out instead of just actually selling them off so that more businesses, more groups can actually use them instead of just a single group?
I got to say, until I hear further from possibly our listeners in the United Kingdom, I'm kind of okay with it. If you have municipal debts and there's property that needs to be sold off to either increase revenue or get rid of debts, I'm okay for different religious groups to be, you know, fronting the money to be able to do that and support the town and our civic government. And I kind of am more in favor of a religiously pluralistic society, contrasted with a monoculture, religious monoculture. So if we can kind of diffuse the Anglican Church and their influence and have something where the more you see, I can imagine a kid saying, all right, here's the Buddhist temple and here's the Muslim community center and here's the Jewish synagogue and here's the other Jewish synagogue and then here's this church and here's the Jehovah's Witnesses and here's the Quaker Friends Meeting House. You know, it might lead to some questions of all of these different people have got their places and all of these people have got their different beliefs and they all purport to have the same one. Maybe we got to investigate that a little bit. So from one area of the country, of the world, that has this burgeoning religious pluralism to a place that definitely does not have a religious pluralism vibe going on, and that's to Malaysia, because right before I went to camp, this thing happened, and I was just really, really shocked by the wording of it. A government official in Malaysia has called for atheists in his country to be hunted down and re-educated. Minister Shahidan Kassim stated that atheism goes against the Malaysian constitution and human rights. The Deputy Minister for Religious Affairs recently ordered religious police to investigate Malaysia's Atheist Republic chapter to see if any Muslims were involved in a recent gathering that garnered widespread mainstream and social media attention. If Muslim apostates were involved in the meetup event, they could be prosecuted for spreading views that jeopardize the faith of other Muslims. Apostates in different regions of the Muslim majority nation might be condemned to religious counseling, fines, or prison. Wow.
Oh, yeah. So has anybody seen Clockwork Orange? Because this is what I keep seeing in my mind, just little things holding your eyes open, watching these horrible movies over and over.
That's the religious counseling re-education part of it?
Yeah.
At that point, would prison be better? Would paying, you know, $2,000 of a fine be better? None of this would be better! None of this is good!
No, that's all bad.
The atheist witch hunt.
We say Malaysia. Yeah, forget you, Malaysia, and the horse you rode in on. Because really, this is not allowing people to defect from their own religion, cramping down on freedom of thought, freedom of belief. I mean, we have people here in our country crying and whining that we're infringing on their deeply, sincerely held religious beliefs because they don't want to see a rainbow as something other than from the story of Noah.
That's God's rainbow.
You got Malaysia.
Then you have Malaysia where people are actually going to be thrown in prison or serve fines or have to go to counseling because of their beliefs.
I mean, this is a very, very serious thing in Malaysia. I mean, they're a very Muslim majority country, as I recall. And being a Muslim apostate is, as I know, the worst thing you could be, basically.
So in doing a little bit of investigation into this, nothing in the federal constitution says that atheism is illegal. But in the different regions, they kind of got like state laws like us where you don't have the ability to defect from your religion. Being an apostate is wrong. You can be an atheist or you can be a Jew or you can be a Christian, but you can't switch.
You know? Can't leave. Like once you're in, you're in forever.
Yeah, it's Hotel California over there. And So you got this thing going on. You have Atheist Republic that does social gatherings and meetups in major cities all around the world. You have, you know, Kuala Lumpur, which is by you know, many accounts, very cosmopolitan, and a beautiful picture of young people, you know, getting together and saying, here we are, we're visible, we're normalizing atheism and secularism. And then various ministers of your country saying, we're going to come and re-educate you because you being an atheist is dangerous to the faith of Muslims. And while, you know, you can be your own religion, you can't threaten the religious beliefs of others because that threatens human rights. The fact that they say that being an atheist is an affront to human rights... You need to study up on these, like, you know, if P then Q, so therefore R things going on. Merely existing as an unbeliever makes you a threat to other people. Maybe your religion, though, it then isn't so fortified. Maybe you need something other than the force of law and Clockwork Orange re-education to bolster up your own beliefs.
Absolutely. I agree with you. This is also a religion that thinks that women are like an affront to men, right?
Second-class citizens.
It's not very, just from a logical standpoint, it's not hard to think why they would feel that atheists are such a
this threat.
Yeah, threat. That
to,
is
to,
the word.
To social order and to the feelings of other people. But lot of places that have an anti-blasphemy law, right, say you can't offend the religious sensibilities of other people. That's bad enough. But this one says if you speak about your existence, if you identify yourself as an atheist, you are a threat to the beliefs. Therefore, laying to bear all of the problems, you might as well just say, you're undermining my social control of people through religion, through these beliefs, using the force of government to do so. And that I just cannot abide. So I don't know what we're going to do with Malaysia, except forget about you and the horse you rode in on, Malaysia.
And not go there.
Yeah. This is Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break with hopefully some uplifting things. We don't know. We might be heading to the obtuse triangle.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. I want to bring it back, but it's
more than basic. Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the third Thursday meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Has Ngadwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster Ngadwe Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an Ngadwe Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. This is Becky Friedman. Our phone number is 844-SKEPTIC. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at any time. But today, we are not taking a voicemail. We are taking a voice call, and we're very happy to have in the studio with us Meredith and Wesley, but on the phone, Brandon Haught. Brandon Haught is a high school science teacher and serves as the communications director of the group Florida Citizens for Science, and he is the author of Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom. Welcome, Brandon.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you here. So I wanted to know, what does your organization, Florida Citizens for Science, actually do? What is the work that you're involved in?
Well, we started way back in 2006, so we've been around for more than 10 years. And, of course, our motto is to promote and defend quality science education here in our state. Unfortunately, the vast majority of our time is spent defending. We formed back in 2006 because we had science standards. The science standards are what dictate to all teachers across the entire state, you know, what they should be teaching in the various science subjects. Well, the last time we had science standards was back in the mid-1990s. And so here we were in 2006, and the State Department of Education was about to start the process of completely rewriting the standards, and we knew for a fact that we were going to face some opposition from creationists and the like, and we were definitely right. The previous version of the standards never mentioned the word evolution. Once the new set of standards were written and released for public comment, evolution was one of the big ideas, so to speak. It was prominent within the standards, and there was quite a bit of backlash against that.
So let me just get this straight.
In the years since, it has been nonstop.
Let me just get this straight, Brandon. Sorry for interrupting, but up until the mid-2000s, there was nowhere that in required Florida State science standards for K-12 that evolution be discussed or taught?
Well, there's euphemisms for it. The word evolution was not in the science standards, but the concept was, you know, changes over time, those kind of things. Back in the mid-1990s, here in Florida, it was the first time we had standards, period. And that was a new effort. And so with a new effort, you wanted to tampen down as much of the controversy as possible. So to keep people from having a backlash against this idea of having statewide standards, well, let's go ahead and remove anything that might be controversial, like this whole evolution thing. So that's why it wasn't mentioned in those state standards. But like I said, it was about 2006, 2007 is when they went ahead and revised them and included evolution by name for the first time.
Goodness. Brandon, what role did you play in Florida's adoption of evolution into the state science standards that finally went in 2008?
Well, our group, Florida Citizens for Science, we all came together. We had people who actually served on some of the committees that did the framework for the standards. And then again, the second round where they actually did the writing of the standards. We then were very public out to the front with the media and stuff like that, making sure that we, you know, promoted these science standards, which were a good set of standards. And of course, there were hearings all around the state, where the Department of Education would say, okay, in Jacksonville, we're going to have a public hearing about these science standards. And we did our best to make sure we had representatives there to speak out on behalf of evolution. Keep in mind that this was the science standards across the board. We're talking physics, we're talking chemistry, we're talking earth-space science. And yet, at these public hearings, the only thing anyone talked about, literally for hours, was evolution. And so, yeah, we had to stay out in front of it, and then right down, we came down to the final vote in front of the State Board of Education. It was a very close vote, but we were there to speak before them, you know, see them eye to eye, and we were fortunate to finally get those standards through.
good on you for being able to just have, you know, the public discourse and still be able to get all of this accomplished, you know, open above board like this.
Well, absolutely. And we breathed a sigh of relief. We're like, fine, yeah, the standards went through, we're okay. But literally 1 week later, the state legislature opened up and a senator filed a bill trying to undo the standards. There was a bill that was kind of one of those academic freedom type bills where, you know, we can call into, quote, teachers should be allowed to call into question this idea of evolution. So we were back at it for another couple months.
So one of the things I heard about more recently from that late 2000s, when finally the science standards went through, was this instructional materials law. Can you tell us about this instructional materials law or bill that went through?
Well, as I said earlier, you know, we were formed back in 2006, and it seems like we've been just running and gunning ever since. So there are some quiet periods every now and then, but it seems like something is always coming up. And sure enough, here in just this past legislative session, there was a bill targeting instructional materials. This was a fascinating bill because it was I learned a lot from it. You're under the impression that it's the lawmakers, it's those senators and those representatives who write to these laws. But I learned the fact that that's not always the case. There's a group in one of the counties here called Florida Citizens Alliance. They were protesting against what's in school textbooks for a couple of years now.
It sounds pretty benign, just the Florida Citizens Alliance. I mean, it sounds like you're interested in civic engagement and things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, come on. they always throw in something that sounds, you know, really nice and positive. You know, the Florida Family Policy Council or something like that, something that sounds all great and positive until you learn it's really deeply conservative and possibly anti-science and stuff like that.
So what was the objective of this Citizens Alliance in terms of instructional materials and how that interfered with the science standards and teaching of science?
Well, it dealt with their constant complaints to their local school board, and they kept on feeling that their complaints were being ignored. And so they actually drafted a copy of a bill to be presented. Then, once they had their draft of this bill, they recruited one of their local lawmakers, and that lawmaker then filed the bill, and then the Citizens Alliance then helped usher it through, and it finally got passed. Now, the thing is that they wanted more power, so to speak. Officially, before the law passed, it was supposed to be primarily just parents who could come forward with the complaints, but now this opens it up to any Florida citizen. Not only that, but now this law forces the school boards to have to take an extra step if someone comes forward with complaints about instructional materials, in that they now have to have a hearing with an appointed hearing officer who would then hear these complaints and then turn around and make a recommendation to the school board. So it's putting an extra burden on these school boards.
Can you explain a little bit about what the role of those voluntary hearing officers play in these kind of proceedings?
Well, like I said, it's the Citizens Alliance really trying to force their local school board, as well as, of course, all the school boards across the state, to listen to their complaints. And they feel that the process that was in place before the law took effect just wasn't giving them a voice. And so it's just this extra step forcing the school boards to have to listen to them and take time to consider their complaints. Now, the problem, of course, is as they were promoting their bill and ushering it through to become law, they had issued all sorts of documentation outlining how they felt they'd been ignored. And among their list of complaints was that they didn't like evolution being taught as a fact. They didn't like climate change being in the textbooks as being something caused by humans. And so if those are the complaints that rightfully the school boards are ignoring. I mean, evolution is fact, period. And so you come forward with a complaint that I don't like how evolution is presented in the textbook. Well, I'm sorry, you have no authority to come forward and propose an alternative. I'm sorry. But now this law is now going to allow the Citizens Alliance to be heard even further on silly complaints like that.
So I know we mentioned it a little bit earlier, but is this just about science topics like evolution and climate change?
No, not at all. And that is actually a very frustrating part of this. The Citizens Alliance actually targets much more history and civics education They don't like anything that even smells like Common Core. Like, they hate Common Core mathematics. So they've been railing against those topics for many, many years. And so the reason why I'm frustrated is because their complaints about science are kind of like footnotes. It's just like, and we also complain about evolution. We also complain about climate change. So we, Florida Citizens for Science, brought this to the public attention. And we're like, hey, this is a big problem. And the frustrating part is no one stood up to defend history or civics or mathematics. We were the only voices out there truly in opposition to this bill, and yet, you know, the targeting of science was just a minor thing.
So these folks that are making up the Florida Citizens Alliance, you know, have a much bigger target sort of in their purview or in their view, in their crosshairs. And it seems like that there's a good call to action for other people that have strengths in civics and science and history to really, in Florida, try and speak up and speak out. Is that kind of what you're saying or seeing? Is there a need for that? Or has someone filled in those roles? Has someone filled in those gaps?
Well, I think there's a serious need for it, and it's not being met here in Florida, and I'm not sure if it's being met anywhere else. But I know that their complaints against science are completely devoid of anything resembling fact. But I'm not an expert at history. I'm not an expert at civics. But if their complaints about science reflect anything about their complaints about the other topics, oh my gosh, people need to come forward and defend these topics. They really do.
So you talked a little bit about earlier, too, about how one of the things that they're doing is just complaining that their voice isn't being heard, the Florida Citizens Alliance. What other kind of tactics or recycled attempts at undermining science education, and what new tricks are up their sleeves?
Well, I always like to tell folks that you know, this whole idea of complaining against evolution, based primarily on some form of creationist belief, that their tactics have evolved. And they truly have.
You know, ironically.
Exactly. And so, yeah, the book that I wrote, Going Ape, is a fascinating historical account, going all the way back to the origins of this back in the 1920s here in Florida, when it was very blatant that, oh, evolution was against the Bible, so we need to outlaw evolution. I mean, it was blatant. That's what they said. That was their complaint about it. But then as the Supreme Court started getting involved, the United States Supreme Court started getting involved and started shutting down those types of complaints, then it moved into, okay, well, we have this idea of scientific creationism, which there's some science behind it. Well, that got shot down. And they were moving towards, okay, this is idea of intelligent design. See, we're not mentioning any type of creator. We're just mentioning some type of intelligent design. That got shot down. And so they keep on have to change to try to get their ideas in. Nowadays, it's more like academic freedom. You know, teachers should have the right to teach controversial materials, both sides of the story, even though you and I both know in science there's one side and it's the right side. And so that's what they're moving towards, is just trying to stir up that, hey, there's some controversy here. Let's make sure that both sides get addressed.
One of the things that just as a teacher in the school year and as part of my daily practice, I just find so infuriating and so off the wall absurd is the states that often have very vocal elected officials who advocate for individual teachers' academic freedom to express their views that the Earth was created in 6 days, 6,000 years ago. You know, those kinds of things. Those are often people in states from the same political party as other elected officials who want to absolutely reduce teacher autonomy in many, many other realms, whether it be through collective bargaining, whether it be through being able to teach English language learner students in their home language, mother tongue, in order to support their learning in the subjects and disciplines outside of actual English development. And it does not hold water for me at all when someone complains that our teachers are being slighted in their First Amendment expression rights through these hamstrung, you know, academic freedom laws. Because we know, you and I both, I'm sure that as public school teachers, we do have limited speech. We are functionaries of the government at that point, and we cannot be coercive to children. What's the climate on that in Florida?
There's a whole bunch of conflict over public education in general. We are a state that is strongly for the voucher programs of you know, somehow providing money to allow your child to go to a school of your choice. And in many cases, that school of your choice tends to be some type of a religious Christian-based school. And if you then research it further, you find out that in that school they teach some form of creationism and they bash evolution. And yet the state keeps on pushing more and more in that direction. You know, I feel what you were just talking about. Now, this is about the start of my fourth year here as a teacher. And just a couple of years before I started, teachers had tenure. And just shortly before I was hired and started as a teacher, the state of Florida got rid of all tenure. So I am just on a simple annual contract.
Whoa.
Wow. And yet, rhetoric around academic freedom from a religious or highly conservative perspective, that rallying call is we want to bolster individual teachers, you know, autonomy. Yet it becomes so clear there is no such kind of, you know,
autonomy.
You
can't have that autonomy if you don't have job security, that you're going to be with the same group of people in the same school with the same kids.
Absolutely. As we were protesting, I guess you could say, against this bill that has now become law. We did have some pushback saying, oh, you're just, you know, what you're complaining about is not actually going to happen. It's not going to come true. Everything's going to be fine. You know, you're just, the sky is falling. And we're kind of like saying, well, no, that's not really the case, because this is not only the letter of the law, but the intent behind it can have a chilling effect on what teachers will present in the classroom. And so someone who might not be as strong, as well-versed in climate change, now has to teach that subject, and knowing that there's controversy over it, might just kind of back off on it a little bit, might not teach it as thoroughly as they really should. The same goes for evolution. They might touch upon it because they, by our standards, they have to teach it, but they might not go into much detail about it. And that chilling effect that this kind of law can, in fact, have. Because now these citizens who come forward to complain about instructional materials, they're going to be emboldened to come forward even more.
I can imagine just how terrifying and demoralizing that would be as a teacher. You know, I'm 15 years or 12 years into my career, and for someone who's rather new, struggling to pay off student loans, going into a profession that maybe isn't as respected or supported, it would have not only a chilling effect on what gets taught in the classroom, but the quality and caliber and consistency of teachers within the state. Moving back a little bit to the book that you published a few years ago, that Going Ape, that conflict, that right. Historical perspective of science education in Florida. You started at the 1920s. You know, you published the book most recently. What kind of updates, what kind of epilogue would you do now that you're 3 years beyond the point? What would you say now is the biggest chapter that's missing from the original publication?
Well, what I try to tell folks when I'm promoting my own book, I'm saying, okay, yes, it's a history book about science education, but it's not really a history book. It does start in the 1920s, and yeah, I had to finish it at some point or else it would never get published. But the bottom line is that it keeps on going. It flows directly into the present day. For instance, of course, I don't have anything in there about the current instructional materials law that just was passed. And so that was definitely, there was a whole bunch of interesting statements made in news reports and stuff, in documents. I mean, I could definitely put together another chapter, tack it onto the book, and I guarantee you within another year I'll have another chapter that I can tack onto the book. This is a living history, I guess you could say.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of other people in other states that have issues like these. How do you advise folks to stay best aware of these issues in their own state?
I have found that those folks who like to attack the teaching of evolution, attack the teaching of climate change, they're very well organized. And to push back against them, you've got to be just as organized. For you to sit there at a newspaper in the morning and read a screaming headline about somebody protesting against evolution and taking from that moment on, trying to form a group and get ready and get going, you're too late. I mean, honestly, you are too late. If you're concerned about anything that might come up in the future in your own state, you need to start, finding like-minded individuals and coming together and saying, strategizing and thinking, if this was to come up, what would we do? And, starting to network within your state. If you're totally lost, you just have no idea where to even start, the National Center for Science Education is an excellent place to start. They have good contacts in pretty much every state and can at least get you started. And then from there, it's just a matter of networking and find other folks that you can stay in contact with and get the work done.
So do you guys have any kind of, you know, wireframe manual for folks? How you did it in Florida or, you know, how we can apply that to Montana or New Jersey or Washington or Oklahoma?
Unfortunately, it was seat of your pants. Just, hey, let's get together. Let's come up with some ideas and let's do this thing. The only thing I can say that I highly recommend is just start and start now. Don't wait for something to happen because by then it's too late.
I think that is a very clear message that we need to get moving. So, Brandon, how can our listeners follow your work or get involved with your organization after hearing all this today? Sure, we have some people.
Well, of course, you can easily find us, Florida Citizens for Science. We have a website with a fairly active blog. We keep updated on Facebook and Twitter. You can find our accounts there. You can, of course, contact us, and we can put you on our mailing list. And we just, you know, just send me an email. My email address is easy to find out there in Florida Citizens for Science. In addition to that, of course, I do have a website for my book, Going Ape. Once again, you just simply look that up, Going Ape Florida, and it'll pull up my website. And I have Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff to accompany that.
Well, Brandon, thank you so much for being able to join us today on this important issue. A little bit of some sobering back to school news, but somewhat of a little break in between all of the other kinds of things that are going on. It's really important to remember as we're facing so much upheaval and so much distressing kind of things around the world, we can anchor ourselves in knowing that we can best educate our youth and our citizens to be critical thinkers in civics, in science, in evolution and climate change, and be activists as well. Brandon Haught is a high school science teacher and serves as the communication director of the group Florida Citizens for Science. He's the author of Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic, and we'll be back after the break with some filling in the blanks because, man, I was away doing all that critical thinking all summer with our little kids, and I missed out on apparently some big info this week.
Billy, I am a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide $1 billion in your locker.
Wow, $1 billion?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
Billy! Billy, I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
Da-da-da-da!
Again? Billy, I'm a certified ghost expert.
Wow, that's so credible.
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you. And to give me your lunch money.
Aw, anything for family. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist without Sam Mulvey. It's still me, Becky Friedman, and with me still are Meredith and Wesley. How are you guys?
Sup?
I'm doing good.
That was my worst metal voice ever. That
was worst
bad.
Metal voice ever?
So bad, sorry.
Well, you know, after an entire week at Camp Quest Northwest, we tend to get bad metal voice as well because we've spent 6 days chasing after 75 youth, but 75 critically thinking youth by this point. You might have heard in our last little commercial break, Billy's progression, and it's... You know, it's been about, 5 years since Billy first was tempted by the devil. And, I think he's learned a lot in those 5 years. We had certain certified ghost experts at camp that seemed to be taken very skeptically and not very seriously by our campers. So that was super fun. We didn't have so much appeal to authority, with Grandma Says So for anything for family. We created our own family at Camp Quest. It would be really fun to be able to say to Billy at the end of camp, hey, our world is that much better, but unfortunately...
It's not.
Oh, man.
Becky, you miss so much.
So I was at a kind of little remote little island, had about 2 hours a day total that I could possibly access the internet between all the running around. I got as far as looking at some headlines here and there, and a few of them I clicked on, and then I started saying, nope, 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 no more clicking on, no more headlines. So about midweek, I just stopped. I went on a Trump-free diet, a Bannon-free diet, wow, a Nazi-free diet, because it was just so sobering and demoralizing to go into that week trying to think about this is what our country is dealing with, this is what we're going through, and really then taking that time, motivating myself and my peers, my fellow counselors, to say we're creating a week long of magic for ourselves and for our youth that we're working with. And we're creating this environment where we can critically examine things and create those bonding, create those bonds and have that skepticism and critically examine our own views and have fun. And it seemed to be like there wasn't that much of that going on outside my little bubble. So guys, what'd I miss?
It was probably the exact opposite of camp. So however nice camp was, just imagine the opposite, because this week has been a trash fire.
Storm. Yes.
I mean, we had some chemical warfare going on. It mostly consisted of 9-year-olds farting in enclosed spaces with 12 other people. Anything of that nature? Or
No, but we did have some interesting flip-flopping from Trump on white supremacists. He came out and actually said that racism is bad.
Oh.
Which is nice.
Okay, so point one for Trump. I don't believe I'm saying this.
Yeah. Get ready to take it back, because the next day he turned around and said that both sides were to blame again and basically said white supremacy is okay.
Huh. And by both sides, we don't mean like inside outside. We're not talking about like summer camp dad jokes. How many sides are there? No.
Oh, that was a dad joke, Becky. I can't.
So we wish that we could make dad jokes about
this. No, we are talking about white supremacists and counter-protesters. So he doubled back down on his initial statement of violence on many sides.
Okay.
But this is after a very alt-right person crashed through 19 people and killed a person, killed a peaceful protester.
So both sides being poster waving, love yelling individual is equally as bad as someone who takes a vehicle and rams them through a crowd, much in the same way that we've had terrorist attacks, perhaps, in various European cities. Like, don't we freak out and call those terrorist attacks?
That's actually a really interesting point. There was a terrorist attack in Barcelona this week. And Trump did immediately freak out and call it terrorism, which is counter to what he said in his Charlottesville statement when asked why he didn't call it terrorism right away. He said he wanted to wait for the facts.
Oh,
he waited 2 days, almost 48 hours to make a statement.
But when it happens overseas, it's immediately terrorism.
Okay.
Obviously. Instantly.
What else happened this week?
Oh, goodness. I didn't think I would ever say this, but I started agreeing with some Republican leaders who were condemning Trump about his lack of speaking out against racists and Nazis. Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, both of the Bushes, they actually made like, these are bad people, we cannot support these bad people statements.
So a majority of Republicans actually disowning this, or is it disowning Trump by proxy? Like, what's going on here?
Some are actually saying that Trump either A is just, milquetoast on this, or that, he is just wrong. Some are, of course, saying that Trump should, speak more authoritatively on his hate for Nazis.
It seems like this is a no-brainer, right? I mean,
yeah, it should be, but it's
do
for
you
some
condemn
reason, it's not.
The most demonized, vilified people in modern history,
but
it's or organization?
Becky. Some of them are good people.
Oh my goodness!
Obviously,
some of them have good ideas. Some of them weren't Nazis, so
well, some of the Nazis are good people.
Yeah, they have families and stuff.
Like. This is all from Trump. I don't have to like slowly back away from the two of you guys right now, do I? I mean, I'm in a trapped studio here, making me a little nervous.
We've spent months slowly backing away from Trump, and this is just us doing it even more.
Okay, so that has to be like the pinnacle of this week, right?
You'd think so. So the whole Charlottesville thing came about because the alt-right group was there to protest the removal of a Confederate statue.
Seems okay. Seems like a step forward, kind of making progress. We don't want to glorify this particular part of our history. We want to acknowledge it, but not glorify it as part of our public displays.
Right. So so this is part of a greater movement to remove Confederate monuments around the nation.
Okay.
In Baltimore, they took one down overnight during the week.
Oh, just that? Just, say this, yeah, this, yeah. This brings, so this is good news then.
Yeah, in Durham, they pulled, a group of counter-protesters actually pulled a statue down.
Oh, so this is actually a people-led movement to start doing this, sort of like how 2 years ago we had the Confederate flag
a bit of
pulled
both.
Down. Okay.
There are people that are taking it into their own hands, but there are government officials that are expediting the process. But Trump is not very happy about this. He thinks that our Confederate monuments are beautiful and that it's very sad.
They're not even gold covered.
To remove this part of our history and culture.
So he's,
this is a great part of our history and culture.
He's suddenly concerned about history and culture right now.
Well,
aesthetics.
He also thinks, what's next? They're obviously going to go after George Washington and Lincoln statues.
Because they owned slaves, so they're bad as well.
I mean, there's an argument there to say let's not glorify that part of our...
There is, but there's a difference between...
traitors against our nation who fought in the Civil War.
Yes, and Washington who owned slaves. Yes, he was perpetuating that part of our culture, but he was not directly causing it.
Okay.
He wasn't fighting against American values as Lee was, as part of the Confederacy.
So. Plus, the Confederacy has such a you know, visually symbolic and auditorily symbolic. I mean, you start humming Dixie and, you know, you do it in a certain context and that can be a threat straight up there, right? You got those symbols, those flags. So there's like, I can feel the need to do that. I can also feel the need to maybe this will be sparking some... you know, some movements or some critical thought about not just Confederate monuments or, you know, streets, airports, bridges named after Confederate heroes, so to speak, but also those who we don't want to, you know, we don't want to honor anymore that maybe perpetuated horrible atrocities against our native peoples, maybe perpetuated really ugly, ugly fights against women's suffrage, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, we have very prominently in our region street names that are for people that committed lynchings against, you know, Chinese people in Washington state.
And I mean, we've got the Lenin statue up in Seattle that they're actively talking about removing.
Oh, I always thought that was kind of like a funny, wacky joke. You know, that's kind of wackadoodle one.
And isn't it on private property anyways?
I don't believe the Lenin statue is on private property. Mm-hmm. There is a Confederate monument in Washington state. It's in a private cemetery. There's a petition to remove it at this point, but I do not know what the outcome of that has been.
Okay,
because it's private land.
Good luck doing that when Trump is saying that it's something beautiful and part of our history. Really, are these Confederate statues like gold flaked? Are they ornate? Are they ostentatious?
No, they're monuments to white supremacy, and that's a beautiful thing, according to Trump.
Most of these were put up during the 1920s, 30s by the Daughters of the Confederates.
Oh, so it doesn't even date from that time period.
No, this is well after, and this was actually a big business that was going on for a long time. Had two competing businesses that were, you know, just putting up, I think there's over a couple of thousand of these statues across the country.
That's crazy. So these statues actually are from a marketing perspective, not trying to honor parts of history, but just trick people into feeling like they need to honor parts of the history just so they'll commission people to buy their statues?
Sounds like it, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so Trump basically says that these ugly odes to white supremacy are actually beautiful, as if Trump has any sense of aesthetics or beauty. But that's gotta top it, right? They're like, nothing else crazy happened this week?
Well, I mean, as a result of that, his entire Arts and Humanities Commission, the people that were remaining, all left and quit.
Wait, what?
Yeah, and they put out an amazing open letter to Trump, and they released it out on Twitter. Like, Kel Penn was one of the people on this team. And when they wrote the letter, if you take the first letter of each paragraph, it spells out resist.
Ooh.
It was awesome.
So we've got definitely some subversive folks that were still on an honorary advisory commission. And
they quit. Okay. They all dropped it.
Hi, yeah. Trump.
So he's been abandoned by his arts council. But I mean, there's still some people that are standing by him, right?
Well, I mean, he got rid of his biggest supporter, I would say. Bannon is gone.
Bannon's gone.
Bannon is out.
Bannon's gone.
Okay.
He's out.
So he's just quit or fired, don't quite know. So he's just laying low now. He's like in the background. He's not in the picture at all.
He is actually licking his wounds out on the beach. No, he's back at Breitbart, and can't quite tell if he's going to be like attacking the White House and Donald or defending the White House and Donald.
Do you think that he's even decided that at this point?
I don't know. I have a feeling that he's going to be on the side of the White House. Trump did tweet out his well wishes to Mr. Bannon.
Did he treat his well wishes to his arts commission?
No.
I do recall seeing a Breitbart writer that just tweeted out hashtag war after Bannon was released. So I don't know.
I don't even know if this is real things or if this is just a recapitulation of people in their 20s wanting to sell more monuments. Are they just wanting to sell more clicks on their webpage?
Yes.
Okay. So we've got that. Speaking of web, you know, this segment is generally called best words. Mm. We've heard some of the best words of Trump saying that, you know, both sides are okay and the monuments are part of our beautiful culture. That's the worst that he's tweeted, right? Like, it couldn't get any worse than that, because I refuse to follow the Trump Twitter feed, and definitely when I'm in my little magical bubble at summer camp teaching kids about how to investigate using chemistry, fingerprinting, substance identification, when we're doing philosophy, when we're going on nature hikes trying to identify native plants according to Lewis and Clark, like, I have no tolerance for the Trump tweets, right? So that was it for the Trump tweets this week, right?
There was another one, and it's not really so much sad or infuriating as it is hilarious.
Okay.
He sent out a tweet twice with the same word misspelled in it.
Let me guess, potato?
Yeah.
Heel.
Like what's on the bottom of your foot, or, you know, like...
Well, that's what he wrote, but he meant the other heel.
In what context is this? Like, is this Bannon licking his wounds? Is this, he has to heal from his wounds?
This was in context of the Boston march on Saturday.
Tell me about Boston, because that's you know, my initial hometown, my original hometown. What happened there? I don't remember. I don't seem to remember any Confederate statues in Boston. I mean, I know that there's some major Revolutionary War monuments. I know that there's beautiful Holocaust memorial made of glass. I know that there's a lot of you know, cultural centers in Boston. What happened there?
A group of alt-right protesters came out to have another one of their free speech rallies.
I'd say maybe 30, maybe 40 at most. There's a small stone building in the middle of a giant,
it's like a gazebo.
Giant green park, yeah.
Oh, so the little round building in the middle of the commons.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
They were, that's where they were at.
In there.
Hidden, cloistered.
Okay.
Surrounded there were, by police.
And thousands of counter-protesters.
All in the streets, like... the police chief of Boston said upwards of 40,000 people.
Whoa.
It was completely peaceful. There were no incidents.
40 white supremacists or Confederate sympathizers and 40,000 counter-protesters. So we're a bit, again, back to too many zeros. They got this like thing. So creationists and white supremacists, they really can't get their factors of 10 straight.
Trump decided he needed to make a statement on the protest in Boston, and his statement was as follows. Our great country has been divided for decades. Sometimes you need protest in order to heal, and we will heal and be stronger than ever before. And heal was misspelled in both places in two tweets that were both deleted.
So H-E-E-L.
And is he, like, he got confused with wrestling. He thinks America's just like a giant like pro wrestling show.
Oh, and he's
now.
The heel. Okay.
He's the heel.
Or is it like telling like roll over, play fetch, play dead.
Heel boy.
Heel. Okay, so is he treating us like dogs? Is that the thing that's going on?
Sit.
Man, that's bonkers. Crazy, it's absurd.
It's a light one.
So
But I gotta say, though, both the police chief and the mayor of Boston put out statements saying that they were just exceptionally happy with the way everything turned out. You know, they both of them put down hate and the alt-right Nazis, you know, can't stand them. They were so happy the way everybody else was just being able to, you know, be peaceful and have their say.
I did hear from one of my friends who still lives in Boston that the Holocaust Memorial was smashed, and so we're looking for some perhaps hopefully prosecution on that end and then rebuilding of that, because it's quite a beautiful statement. You know, everyone understands and recognizes smokestacks as that symbol of concentration camp crematoria, and instead of smokestacks that emit smoke, you have these clear glass pillars that are reminiscent of that, but carry the names of the people who perished. And as someone who grew up in the Jewish community in the Boston area, it's quite moving and quite like interesting reminder of, yes, this didn't happen in Boston. You know, yes, we are a secular society, but we can recognize and honor the loss of people within a particular community that have been reestablished in this area. And that was a tough one to see for me personally, to see that smashed. So hopefully we'll be, that was what I had heard about Boston. So I'm very much, lifted in spirits to see that there were upwards of tens of thousands out, in support of condemning these kinds of actions and these kinds of words.
Rather glorious.
So, man, okay, that was a little bit of a downer for this week with all of these best words. I think we have to redefine what the word best means. But one of the things I'm really excited and looking forward to this week is the eclipse, because here in Western Washington in the Northwest, up here, you know, we're not quite in the full coverage area, but I think we're going to have about 93% coverage. Mm-hmm. I've got my glasses. Wesley, you've got welding goggles, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That are kosher for...
They'll work.
Yeah, so there's going to be some awesome viewings. It was really fun to check out all of our campers from Camp Quest with a set of safety sun viewing goggles, sun viewing glasses, and a little slip of paper that explains what the eclipse is and how to safely view it. I'm planning on passing them around tomorrow morning, and we'll see how that goes. We'll see how the animals, you know, react and if anyone goes to sleep, and hopefully Trump will not say something dumb, because, you know,
it's fake news.
He tends to tweet late at night, right? His most bizarre tweets are late at night.
Should we be looking for some tweets during the totality then?
I think so, because what if, like, I'm just imagining Trump is, you know, looks outside and he sees, oh, it's nighttime. It's my new Fox News watching time and my incoherent tweeting time. So, you know, maybe around 2 p.m. in Washington, D.C. or New Jersey or wherever he seems to be at this point, you know, we should keep on a lookout, because I heard that animals may get confused and think it's actually nighttime. So we should take a look at that. But speaking of the eclipse, not everyone understands the eclipse from a scientific perspective, do they?
Mm. It appears not.
So, Wesley, you were doing some research and thinking of some different things and interested in that. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's taking place, twice in a lifetime. I remember in the mid-90s. But it's a pretty memorable lifetime sort of event taking place tomorrow. Many will be sharing in the lovely occurrence across the continental USA. Not all will simply see the moon pass in front of the sun. There's a few interesting things that religious people will see at this time and will do during and after the eclipse. Take it away, Wesley.
So, yeah, Hindus. The Hindi tradition is quite specific on this. Pradeep Reddy, who is a member of the board of the Hindu Temple and Cultural Society of Southern Illinois, said his community will go over the guidelines this weekend. So first, enjoy the eclipse. Afterward, don't eat any food cooked before the eclipse.
Wait, whoa. Does the eclipse have effect on our ovens or on our microwaves or things like that? Like, we can't have leftovers? Like, leftovers, not good, throw it away?
Yeah, clean it all out.
Okay.
It gets even more interesting. If you stored any drinking water in your house before the eclipse, discard it. Try not to conceive a child around the eclipse time because they have a fear of birth defects.
Wait. This goes in complete contrast to that one individual who posted seeking someone to specifically conceive a child in Oregon.
Drugs were okay, too.
Yeah, and in a very, very specifically requested positioning and mutual understandings of philosophical things.
So, this person must not have been Hindu.
So they wouldn't have been Hindu. So you can't so no intimacy during right. eclipse time.
Well, I mean, just no child, you know, just don't make a child.
Okay.
Purify yourself and the clothes that you wore to watch the eclipse by either walking right into the shower, clothes and all, or go take a shower and then, you know, wash your clothes right in the laundry right afterwards. You don't want to drip you don't want to drip water all around your house as you go room to room. Purifying your house.
Okay, so we need to purify ourselves and the house and everything after the eclipse. Don't eat anything or drink anything from before the eclipse. Got right. it. Any other religions have a perspective on this?
The Muslims. They'll actually be reciting a prayer.
Not super surprising. It's a kind of an interesting natural occurrence.
It is, but it's kind of for a sad reason. Muhammad had a very young son, Ibrahim ibn Muhammad, who died reportedly during or right after an eclipse. Ibrahim died when he was between 16 and 21 months old, depending on which eclipse that you try and line up his death with.
Okay, so, maybe not particularly attributable to the eclipse. I mean, maybe during that time period, it was not particularly unusual for young tots to perish, to not thrive, to not survive. So, mm-hmm. but in Muslim faith, it seems to have been linked specifically with the eclipse.
With, like three different eclipses. That's why there's either 16, 18, or 21 months old when he died.
Okay. All right. So what else?
Across a couple interesting things about Jewish people. There are specific blessings for lightning, flowers, and even rainbows, but nothing specifically for an eclipse. Lunar eclipses could be seen as ill omens, I've been told, for Jewish people because they follow a lunar calendar.
So a little bit, I would imagine, since I was fairly involved in Jewish culture for a while, there's a blessing that you say that is sort of, it's called Shehechianu, and it's said at a time when anything momentous occurs. So the first time something happens. So Hanukkah is 8 days, but you say the Shehechianu on the first night. Of Hanukkah. Passover is 8 days, but you say Shehechianu on the first night of Passover. You get a new suit that you're really interested in wearing and happy, and it's the first time you're putting it on. You say Shehechianu for this new thing you're experiencing. A baby is born. Shehechianu. A new flavor of tea that you're trying. Shehechianu. The first time you baked a cake by yourself. Shehechianu. First time that you may experience intimacy. Shehechianu. So that would be the one that I would be guessing on from my non-rabbinical liturgical perspective. Hmm. Definitely lunar calendar. There's a lot of Jewish feminist women that find affinity with a lot of the observances related to the moon, since it sort of aligns with a lot of things related to feminine identity within an ancient perspective. So we've got Jewish folks, we've got Muslims, we've got Hindus. Anything else?
Oh, yeah. There's a little bit more. Catholics. I was a little sad to see that Father James Martin, who's a Catholic author and expert on all manner of obscure saints, said he didn't know of a patron saint for eclipses.
Oh, that would be awesome, because didn't the Catholic Church just lower the bar for sainthood? Like, you don't actually have to perform that many miracles, sort of fast track it?
Yeah, they keep lowering it.
Okay, so something major at the Vatican has to occur, and some priest has to be involved, and then, you know, that seriously, patron saint of eclipses.
Last one. Goodness. Evangelical Christians seem to like their end time predictions, and I'm sure there will be a family or two in their basements or bunkers. Taking cues from passages like Acts 2, I will show wonders in the heavens and above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and glorious day of the Lord. A popular theory right now is that in certain evangelical circles, they say the rapture will occur on September 23rd, which is 33 days after the eclipse.
Wait. What special significance does the number 33 have?
Well, because, of course, 33 days later, because Jesus.
Okay, 33 days, Jesus, 33. Okay, so yeah. blood, moon going, sun going dark, all those things. What's that's the smoke and billows of smoke? Oh, we had all of the forest fires from Alberta and British Columbia, so we already had the billows of smoke.
And the eclipse is going to touch down in Oregon first, which I'm sure they had some of that smoke down there too.
Oh yeah, wow. Very smoky and across the whole northwest of the continent. And so we've had, and then in the nighttime through the smoke, you know, that full moon, about 2 weeks ago.
Bloody.
Oh, looks awfully red. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know. Do you guys have bunkers? Do you guys have plans for the eclipse?
Just going to be watching it from work.
Yep, totally. Even though my office told us that we can't, I'm still going to.
Okay. All right. Well, we hope that everybody who is in any portion of viewing, whether it's totality, whether it's partiality, that we're able to view and enjoy the eclipse and enjoy it for what it is, just a mere passing of the moon between the sun and our planet Earth. This is Ask an Atheist. Give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. Tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA. Thank you, Meredith.
Thanks, Becky.
Thanks, Wes, for joining us this afternoon.
It's always awesome.
Afternoon. Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. I'm producing this week's episode, Becky Friedman. This has been Ask an Atheist and an awesome week back. Hopefully, we'll have fewer bonkers things that go on next week when we see you then.